Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, February 2nd, 2012. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, the power of imagination is our theme. We're going to be talking with John Rappaport about the nuts and bolts of the Matrix, how to see the game, and how to build your immunity to both the Matrix and getting tricked. We're going to go an hour and a half tonight, so don't worry if you can't stick with us. The audio will be up tomorrow and the transcript up next week. My apologies for my cold. I sound a little bit like Lauren Bacall, but I feel just fine. A couple of items before we get going. The wrap-up transcript is up to the wrap-up. I know we did at the beginning of January. It's special graphics. It's really a great resource. If you haven't had a chance to check it out, I recommend it. I was up in the Rogue Valley last week. I did a series of events in Ashland and Medford. We'll put a review of that up when the folks up there write it up. There was a great conversation about, we did a workshop on building individual and family wealth, and then another one on currency, community currency, and how to build community wealth. We got into equity and municipal expenditures. It was very nuts and bolts. And then went on to a big speech on the big macro issues. I talked about law, freedom, leadership, love, you know, all sort of the big issues. Coming up next week, next Saturday, February 11th, I'm going to be in Palm Springs, California for Cambridge House's Natural Resources Conference. For those of you in Southern California, attendance is free. My speech will be Successful Investing in Natural Resources, Key Issues for the Retail Investor. I'll be attending all day, so if you make it over, just let me know you're a subscriber, and I'll do my best to make time for your questions. Money and markets. Well, this week you could say so much for globalization. The currency and economic warfare just went to a new level. We saw the German Bourse New York Stock Exchange deal valued at $7.4 billion bite the dust. There's really quite a clever campaign by the opposition in Berlin and Brussels, but the deal was nixed by the, quote, EU competition commissioner on the theory that it will lead to a near monopoly in European financial derivatives worldwide. Meantime, the negotiations for another Greek debt workout just continued with constant pain. If they make a movie about this, it'll be called The Endless Agony. Steady reports of continuing loss of sovereignty by the Greek government and people. Greece would be much better off just giving up, leaving the euro, returning to the drachma, and taking its pain, but there's no sign that that will happen. Stay tuned for a deal announcement and the details of how ugly this is going to get. In the meantime, we saw the Department of Justice attack on Switzerland's oldest bank, Vakland, reach a new level. The bank had customers pull over $4 billion of assets and was forced to sell, and so they are no longer Switzerland's oldest bank. A comment in the Reuters report, which is up on the blog, he said in a separate interview, but reported by Reuters, that he feared U.S. authorities were likely only to tighten the noose around the Swiss financial sector. The end of the bank, this is a quote, the end of the bank Vagland is only the prelude to a big attack on the Swiss financial sector. He told the magazine, a solution to the tax dispute will likely be very expensive for these banks. It's not surprising that this is happening, and you can see it by looking very closely at the biggest story of the week that got very little announcement, but thanks to Bruce Casting, got quite a good description, and it's posted up on the blog. The Congressional Budget Office posted its annual report, and it's quite a doozy, lots of pictures and graphs. They are projecting after the election that growth in the U.S. economy drops to 1%. Now, remember, this is the Congressional Budget Office publishing this in a presidential election year. So it's not just a congressional election year, it's a presidential election year, and that's quite amazing. So they're showing a drop. They show over 2% growth this year, drop to 1% growth in the year after the election. They show unemployment growing from 8.9% to 9.2%. As those of us who read shadow stats know, it's really actually much higher. But they also show the Social Security Fund topping out in 2019 instead of 2022 and topping at $2.6 trillion instead of $3.4 trillion. That's almost a $1 trillion swing One of the things you look at if you read the report is that individual taxes in the current budget are way down. When I was doing stories on the missing money in 2000 to 2012, individual taxes were approximately $1.6 trillion a year. They're down to 1.15. That shows you how painful things are. Corporate taxes down even more, approximately 50%, almost cut in half. A lot of that is legal, moving things offshore, but it shows you how income has dramatically fallen and taxes have dramatically fallen with it. And so you can, it's not surprising we see the Department of Justice competing or doing everything it can to force bank deposits back and to force taxes back, because the ability to afford the leakage is not there. And if you look at what the CBO is saying about Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid expenses, what you know is that after the election, there's some very hard questions that are going to have to be faced. We've been asking the question here for a long time. If you basically, between the missing money and the bailouts, take all the retirement money and shift it out, whether legally or illegally, what's the end game? What's the exit plan? Not surprisingly, after the CBO study came out, Gallup announced the polls on Obama. They look absolutely dreadful. And following both the Gallup announcements and the CBO annual report, what happened? We see DOD now saying they're going to bring the Afghan troops home much faster than had previously been expected. It's proof that popular opinion matters, or at least popular financing does. It wouldn't surprise me if the CBO annual report probably had a greater impact. Meantime, we're watching unbelievable amounts of media on the presidential election. What was interesting, in the Rogue Valley, we had a number of subscribers and other colleagues come and go to all the events. It was quite wonderful. It made for a much richer conversation. And finally, at the fourth event, somebody asked me about the election, and I realized I hadn't brought it up once in any of the workshops. It hadn't struck me that it was relevant to a serious conversation. And the question was sort of, you know, I guess you don't think it's very important. But if you watch the media, you can understand why I say that. There's every effort being made to try and create a sense of competition and drama where there is none. The Republicans are trying to make Gingrich versus Romney look interesting. They continue to give Ron Paul the opportunity to get some coverage, and that's only because he's about one of the few things that has created any authentic interest. Again, as I said, I'm in California, so of course in the gym I see lots of media coverage that I wouldn't see normally. One of the things about getting us out of Afghanistan early, it does increase the chances at a Republican convention, that is one very brilliant subscriber pointed out. We could get Jeb Bush coming in as a dark horse at the last minute, and of course that would be very concerning, but is there a chance it could happen? Yes, I think there is. Big story in the markets this week, Facebook is doing its IPO with an outrageously rich valuation. There's so much interest that I decided to go over to the SEC, and Darlene Heckman for us got a copy of the preliminary prospectus, which is filed in the Edgar system, and we put it up on the blog. If you want to read the preliminary prospectus, Morgan Stanley is the lead underwriter, J.P. Morgan, co-senior manager with Goldman Sachs on the right. Interesting, I would have expected to see Goldman on the left as the lead, but no, it's Morgan Stanley. It's interesting, this is a very frustrating deal to watch. It's very much being parlayed as the get-rich-quick sort of deal, how successful Facebook has been, how much the early investors are going to make. It's a little bit depressing because it means lots of money for centralization and the compromise of personal privacy. Given the size of and the ad revenues, if Facebook could convert to a viable business model, but it's one in which the customer is paying the intelligence agencies to maintain data on all of them. Another disturbing story, Occupy Oakland continues on its lose-lose trajectory. I hope the other occupies aren't this bad. The Oakland mayor has announced that so far the municipality has lost $5 million dealing with this. And we have a story of a teenager angry with his parents. Apparently, they tried to stop his participation, murdered them, and put their bodies in the backseat of the family car. If that's true, It sounds like a situation involving significant mind control operations to me. Again, bad for small businesses and citizens in Oakland, certainly not bad for Wall Street, so good for the centralization team. Our hero tonight, you're not going to be surprised, is John Rappaport, and I'll go more into that as I introduce him. But first, a few questions and ask Catherine. There are two questions I wanted to address tonight. The first is, I got another question about the Iraqi dinar scheme. For those of you who are too busy doing relevant and important things, there has been a real effort to persuade people that they can make hundreds of millions of dollars and hit the lotto on a reintroduction of the Iraqi dinar. I'm constantly getting questions about this. Franklin Sanders is also constantly getting questions about this. Here's the reality. If you look deeply behind the descriptions of what's going on, what you're talking about is a financial play designed to make money from the conquest of a country and the genocide of a people. And frankly, to me, that has a highly negative return to the whole ecosystem. And if you look at the sort of people engaged in what they're talking about a get-rich-quick scheme that more often than not loses money to the investors. So it's basically, if you look at the Solari model, it's a lose-lose on both of the sort of two tests. We like to make money for the ecosystem as a whole, and we like to make money for ourselves. The theory that the people who engineer these kind of frauds are going to let the outsiders in on big windfall profits is not likely. So every once in a while, we see a get-rich-quick scheme that works, and of course, that's to keep everybody on the hook and harvested. And what I have to tell you is you're much better off finding a legitimate way to add value and make money. And please don't ask me ever again about the Iraqi dinar scheme, because it's offensive both to me as a human being and also as an investor. Another question. I've enjoyed your interviews and the level of intelligent discussion. I've not read them all, but I've reached a point for a question. You are an investment advisor, and your title is helping individuals and families increase their wealth. Do you have a plan for me? What is your advice, Rat, going to take? I am a retiree in 89 with reasonable alertness. Maybe your objective is to satisfy a person in a family formation stage. Maybe your target is someone who has a nest egg and needs direction. Maybe you're also trying to educate your audience to the frailties of this society in the U.S. and its political system. I liked Godfather 3, trying to go straight, and the farther he went up the church, the more corrupt he found. Is this the thing we have to deal with? Great question. The problem is that my plan for any individual is very much organized around what your purpose is, where you are, place is very important, how you like to spend your time, what your goals are for you and your family, if you have family, and how, you know, what are your current assets, whether intellectual capital or financial assets, and how are they currently invested. So without lots of information about you, everything has to organize with what's in your heart and where you want to go in this world. And without knowing that, I would never have the chutzpah to come up with a plan for you. So I'm happy, if you want to share more, to answer another round in Ask Catherine. So with that, let me turn to our conversation at hand. As I said earlier, John Rappaport has very graciously offered to go on the half an hour, so we are going to speak until we're going to go an hour and a half total for this Solari report. And I just want you to know I could talk to John Rappaport for 10 hours straight. He and I have talked sometimes about having a free bridge call where we do just exactly that. We have a marathon. There's a great song that says, "Don't let the walls close in on you." And I must say, if you try to, I'm a person who loves freedom. Freedom is the most desirable state for me. It's, being free is more important than being alive. I'd rather be dead than be a slave. I truly have the Spartacus spirit in me. But the first thing you understand, if you care about freedom, is the key to being free is that you need your mind to be free. John and I were talking earlier today, and we said that there are two classes of people those who believe they have the power and the right and the know-how to create their world, and those that feel they do not have that power and buy into a world created and invented for them. And we all grow up more or less as prisoners, sort of a cobweb of lies, and they're often told to us by loved ones who don't know any better. And it's our journey to slowly untangle those lies and remove ourselves and those we love from outside of that cobweb or matrix and create the capacity to create our own pictures. And as I look back on my life and the people who most helped me understand how to do that, John Rappaport, as I said in my blog post, is certainly one of the most important and is just a ongoing source of intellectual power and delight and just laughter. There's nobody in this world who can make me laugh the way John Rappaport can make me laugh. It's the laugh you make when you are truly just understanding and appreciating the lusciousness of freedom. John has been a writer and investigative reporter for many years. I'm going to ask him to go through his background and history because it's absolutely fascinating. He has his own website at No More Fake News. He's got books. He's got audio seminars. He's got interviews. He also does consultations for those who really want to access and tap into him. He's married to someone many of our subscribers know because she's been on the Salieri Report several times and is my nutritionist, Dr. Laura Thompson. I met her through John. And John, as an investigative reporter, had a profound knowledge of the healthcare system. But then when he married Laura, then it just, you know, it went into exponential overdrive. His experience and knowledge is deep, and I have all, you know, I always loved his books. I got onto John Rappaport, I think, in the late 90s. But one of the things I did was I signed up for a service where he would write interviews. He would write, he would give someone anonymity so they had pseudonyms, and he would interview people who'd been on the inside and the nuts and bolts of the bureaucracies in public relations, in medicine, in healthcare, in therapy, in the church, in just, you know, all different walks of life. And these interviews were profoundly illuminating if you're someone like me who's interested in the economics and operations of how control is engineered. And so one of the things I did was I encouraged John. I said, look, please make your interviews accessible because I constantly recommend them to my clients and investors and subscribers. And then they come back and say, well, how do I can't get them. So John has come out with a new product, and we're going to talk about it tonight and some of the materials in it called The Matrix Revealed. It's a CD. It's up on his website. You can link to it from the blog post. And I just have to tell you, if you want to have a library with the core materials of books that really illuminate how the world works, John Rappaport's works, including this new CD, are, as far as I'm concerned, they are one of the core must-haves in any library on this stuff. This is just invaluable, invaluable knowledge. So without further ado, John, are you with us?
I am indeed.
Okay, so tell us how you became an investigative reporter and writer.
1982, I had a friend who was working. First of all, it's great to be here, as always, with you.
Oh, thank you.
And she was working at the LA Weekly as a copy editor. I had never done any journalism before. And I was busy writing fiction poetry. She came up to me one day and she said, you know, I think they want an interview with somebody that you might know who knows about the nuclear freeze and nuclear weapons and so on. And I said, gee, well, that would be pretty easy. And she said, well, try it on spec and see what happens. And so I interviewed a friend of mine who was very knowledgeable about all this at the time, 1982. And they took it, they published it, they put it on the cover, they paid me. And I thought, gee, this is the easiest thing in the world. And I began taking assignments from LA Weekly to do more. I interviewed the president of El Salvador University, where the military had taken over the campus and they were disappearing people and killing people and burning books and so on. And I said to him, you have a dangerous job. He said, better not speak about it. 4 years later, he was dead. And I began to think, well, this is personal. This is serious. This is real. And so I better dig in here and see what's going on. And as the years rolled by in the 1980s, I was writing for more and more magazines and newspapers on political issues, on health issues. And eventually I began to see that everybody had a bias. If I could fit through their keyhole with my article, they would publish it. If I couldn't, they wouldn't. And so I was like a shopper who was going around to people who struck me basically as, I would say, modified lunatics, who had such frozen views of reality that it became very difficult for me to get certain of my articles published by anybody, because they would always turn the subject to their biases and prejudices. And I naively thought that in an adult world, this wouldn't happen. That people would grow up and realize that, you know, stories are stories, information is information, the truth is a truth, and wherever it falls, let's run with it. And that was not the case at all. And I began to become very irritated in the late 80s when I was really shut out and blacked out of a number of publications because I just simply refused to write partisan tripe. And at the same time, it was also coming upon me that the real questions to be looked at were, who's running the world? How are they doing it? What is control? How is it exercised? What is the reality which we are being dealt? And how can I penetrate way below the surface of that? About which none of the professionals I talk to in the field of journalism were the slightest bit interested.
I have, as the quote du jour up on the blog today, a quote from Upton Sinclair. It says, "It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it."
Yeah. Right. And also you can put in owners, too, as well as paid
right.
employees, because I talked to publishers of magazines who owned these things. They had nobody to answer to but themselves, and they still refused. So I quit in the late 80s, and I decided that it was time for me to get more serious than I had been even, and to begin to plunge into various worlds. And I started with this premise. Most people think they know everything that needs to be known. Professionals are quite sure that they know everything that needs to be known. And even people who describe themselves as liberated generally refuse to believe that they have blind spots, gigantic blind spots, where they think they know something that they don't. And this was my obstacle. How was I going to proceed and cut through all of this? And I decided that the way to do it was to discover such mind-boggling information that it would simply kind of operate like a bulldozer and force people into realizing that even if they consider themselves free, liberated, brilliant, geniuses, whatever, that everybody has blind spots, and those blind spots specifically relate to how the picture of reality is being painted for us, where we are being magnetized to some aspect of that picture where we're buying in, we're living in the picture that's being created for us, and we don't even know it. We think we're on the cutting edge, and in fact, we are just being
cycled down,
imagined for. Someone else is cooking up reality and selling it to us, and we are buying it. They're inventing it out of whole cloth. And so I began to look at reality as a series of ops or operations that were forwarded by various planetary elites that had various specific goals in mind, the most basic of which was to hypnotize people into accepting the painting that was being painted for them, to say, yes, these are the facts, yes, this is what's going on, yes, and therefore I have to do this, or I have to do nothing, or whatever it is. And that's where I began. So in 2001, or actually 2000, just before the presidential election, I started my site, No More Fake News. And soon after that, I was dealing with the election, and then with 9/11, and everything began to blow up. I mean, the interest generated by what I was writing was much greater than anything I'd experienced in the conventional field of journalism. And then, as you referred to earlier, the big breakthrough for me was, suppose I could contact people who had formerly been on the inside of these elite groups, who are actually imagining and creating reality for us in a number of venues, and suppose I could interview them off the record. Suppose that they had come to their senses enough to realize that they wanted to spill the beans on how it's done. How is reality created? Politically, economically, medically, artistically, religiously, you name it, in any field of endeavor. And suppose they were willing to talk to me about their experiences inside the matrix. What would happen then? And so I began a very laborious process of discovering some of these people, vetting them, making sure that they were who they said they were. And then I began to do extensive interviews with them, which were then my Friday newsletters, of which there were hundreds that are
which
now.
Which I live for. It was the one thing, as soon as that interview came in, I would stop doing whatever I was doing. I would print it out, and I would sit down and read it. And for years, I moved around with this huge pile of printed out John Rappaport interviews, which were kind of like the, you know, the treasure. And so can we just go through some of the greats, some of the highlights? Because it was, I don't know how many interviews there were, but there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages.
This new product, Major Revealed, has 250 megabytes of information compressed down on one CD. And that includes, for example, with one of my insiders, Jack True, 43 interviews, 320 pages. Ellis Medavoy, who we'll talk about, who is the propaganda expert. I think there are 30-some-odd interviews with him here, and they, you know, run to a few hundred pages. And there were many other people that I interviewed, and it just blossomed. It went crazy.
Yeah, 'cause I think a lot of these people really wanted to tell all. You know, you could tell this was very therapeutic for them, particularly after 9/11. You had a lot of people who had worked on the inside who were looking around and saying, something's really wrong. So to me, I think, well, let's just dive in because, of course, my favorite, you know, are Ellis Medavoy. Why don't we start with Ellis Medavoy, and why don't you tell us who he was and how you came to find him, and then let's talk about what he said.
Okay, Ellis Medavoy is a pseudonym of a retired propaganda expert. Some people would call it psyops, propaganda, PR. It's all the same thing. He was a master of inventing realities that would then find their way into the press. That was his expertise. And this involved cultivating, quote, reliable sources who would then become the sources for reporters and editors, major reporters and editors all over the world. So he was two levels removed. And so he spent his life cultivating these reliable sources that he knew had the very close attention of major reporters and editors in major media outlets, and he floated information and stories, lies, paintings of reality that were completely false to these people, and made sure that they found their way into the press and became common knowledge. That was his job. He worked for a number of different people, including, I finally got him to confess, a few insiders who had their own kind of core group within the Council on Foreign Relations headquartered in New York, which is basically a Rockefeller group. But he worked for other people as well, especially in the medical apparatus. I met him. It was a series of kind of bewildering synchronicities through Jack True, a hypnotherapist friend of mine, had connections there. Other people who pointed me toward Ellis. It was difficult to set up a conversation with him. All of this happened actually way before I ever started my website in the late 80s, early 90s. And he and I had several conversations, and I said, someday you're going to want to talk to me on the record, off the record. He said, absolutely not. He said, I'm not even talking to you off the record now. He said, I don't even exist. You know, he said, you're just talking to yourself. But because you seem to be an interesting guy, you know, you can imagine that I'm talking to you. And we've had sort of these bizarre conversations that went on like that, you know, with lots of dangling participles and clauses like, if I were here, and if I were saying something to you about something that I supposedly knew about, this is what it would be, possibly. And so I kind of gave up after a while. But once I started my website, I cemented that relationship, and I assured him that I would be able to publish interviews that would be completely off the record and that thousands of people would be able to read. And you're right, after 9/11, everything changed. And he became extremely remorseful and regretful on one level, while remaining very thorny and prickly on another, and consented to do a couple of interviews, which blossomed into many, many interviews. And I remember things he said to me from the interviews and outside the interviews even. And he said, for example, he said, look, everything is an op. Even what you don't think is an op is an op. It's an operation. It's something that is launched with a purpose, a goal. Its strategy is always to deceive. People like me, he said, invent reality and we shove it down your throat. That's what we do. Now, he said, you have your choice. You can look at it that way or you can refuse to believe it. If you refuse to believe it, we really have nothing to talk about, because I'm going to tell you the nuts and the bolts of how I operated, how I worked, what I did in various venues on different subjects, medical, political, etc., etc. And I will tell you stories. For example, the story of Al-Qaeda. He said, this is like a disease that does not exist. There are lots of people with lots of symptoms around the world. So what happens? A pharmaceutical company, with their consultants and researchers, sits down and says, look at all of these people with all of these symptoms. Suppose we isolate these five symptoms and we come up with a name for this. We don't care why these people have the symptoms. We don't care whether they have the symptoms for the same reasons. Doesn't matter. They don't, but it doesn't matter. All we want to do is boil this down to five symptoms, invent a name for it, and then cook up a story that will convince the world that we have discovered a new disease.
I wish we also
we will
have a new disease.
Congeal this down. And he described this to me, you know, a chapter and verse. He said, this is the way they operate. You could say this is marketing, he said, but you have to understand the pseudoscience behind the way they market. This is how they do it. And so let's say we call this new disease X. Now we have to find a germ that causes X. Because if we can say we found a germ that causes this X disease, we can wipe off the board everybody else who might say, but wait a minute, some of these people that have these symptoms are suffering from radiation poisoning or chemical pollution, or the fact that they've taken too many medical drugs and their immune systems are compromised, or the people in certain countries don't have enough to eat and they're starving. And so, you know, I mean, come on. We have to wipe all that off the board immediately, you see. We have to find one virus, give it a name, and say it is the cause of the new disease called X. And then we have created a painting, an op, a coalescence of factors that are spread out all over the map, and we have now congealed them into one entity that we can sell with a name. We'll call it, you know, UBLA-D. This is the new disease. And we can say it's either an outbreak in progress, an epidemic, or we can say it's a chronic, debilitating disease that we've just discovered and researched, and we've discovered the virus that causes it.
But we take a complex phenomenon and we make it simple. It's kind of like an adult fairy tale. It's simple.
Yeah.
So getting
and
back
he said
to Al-Qaeda,
to me,
Al-Qaeda is simple. It's
he
one
said,
thing.
This is Al-Qaeda. He said, this is Al-Qaeda. He said, that's the metaphor for Al-Qaeda if you want to understand Al-Qaeda. Yeah, there's all kinds of crazy people running around all over the world. And they have symptoms relating to wanting to destroy things in the name of whoever or whatever. Or they're paid to. Or, you know, you can't even begin to try to summarize the whole situation. He said, but just like in the pharmaceutical situation, planners, strategists, analysts, think tanks, elite groups like CFR, Council on Foreign Relations, can sit down, not the general body of CFR, but a few insiders, and say, look, we have an opportunity here of something we can sell. We need to put a face on terrorism. We need a name. We need a title. We need a mythology. We need a painting that we can paint and sell it and scare people with it. And then we can make billions and trillions off of it. And we can, most importantly, increase the level of control over the citizenry of the planet, which is our ultimate aim. Because with control comes everything else we want. Wealth, et cetera, et cetera. Whatever we want, it comes as a byproduct of control. So let's do it. What's the name going?
I don't know if I ever told you this, because I know he probably works as the executive committee at the CFR, but when I was going through the litigation, when the really bad part started in 98, suddenly every couple days I would get a call from a friend of mine who was in the CFR, or a colleague or associate, and they'd say, oh, you know, I want to take you out to lunch. I want to have you over for dinner. And then they would lobby me. And when the lobbying started, they would be all excited because they had been asked by someone in the higher echelons, you know, to do this mission. They were on an anointed mission for, you know, who knows who called them, Bob Rubin, somebody like that. And they were all jazzed up and energized. And it was like talking to somebody who was in a trance. And it would take me half the lunch or half the dinner to talk them down with the facts. And just trying to get them interested in the facts was a struggle. And when I would finally get them interested in the facts and try and explain to them why I wasn't going to do whatever cockamamie thing they were proposing I do, they would realize, you know, that they were acting without logic and what they were asking me to do was nuts, you know, either nuts for me or nuts for the world. And as I talked them down, they'd start to get scared. And that's when I really, you know, I used to think of all those people, John, as having real power. But what I realized was they had no power. Not only, they had no logic. In other words, they got the call. They were thrilled to get touched by, you know, maybe it was a Rockefeller. They were thrilled for the association. And they were said, you know, just go do this. And they didn't even think You know, there was no critical thinking going on. And what I realized is these people have no power. They're just so delighted to be sort of, you know, in a peripheral circle on the inside that they just don't think and they do whatever they're told. And it was frightening because, you know, 35 people who I thought had real power had absolutely no power. They were just, you know, a poodles. They were on a leash.
And a couple of conversations.
You know, but I'm sure all the stories they were bringing me came from the, you know, the story, the kind of stories that Alice Mattavoy was spinning. Because
exactly.
Their pictures of reality was sort of oversimplified, phony, and stupid.
That's exactly what he told me. He
right.
said, my job is to cater to people's basic stupidity. And
right.
I mean, we're talking about a guy who had a very, very cynical view of humanity. And that was mollified and softened eventually after 9/11 when he began to realize, you know, what, some of what he had created. But to this day, on a given afternoon, he will still give you that extremely cynical view of humanity, of even people in so-called high echelons of importance and so on and so forth. You know, he said, look, it's like selling candy to a baby, but the only thing that you have to realize is you need enough complexity so that people will throw up their hands and say, it must be right, I can't understand it, so I'm going to go along with it, because
right,
everybody else is saying that it's true. He said, one of my jobs was spin it with enough, just enough complexity so that the overwhelming majority of people will say, there is no way I can penetrate through this. I'm going to have to accept it. And that's what he did. He did this to his reliable sources. They would say, I don't understand what you're saying, Ellis. And he would say, well, you can't understand it because it involves medical science. Obviously, you don't know what's going on in laboratories. You could go to the National Institutes of Health and stand in one of these laboratories for 3 weeks, look over the shoulder of the researchers, and you would understand even less than you know now. He said, so what I'm giving you is from the top echelons of the National Institutes of Health. Now, do you want to go with it or not? I can give you the sources to talk to there. I can give you the questions to ask them. I can give you the exact quotes to fish for, and you'll have major stories. And, of course, they would all go along, these reporters, just the way you just described. The reporters go along because they don't know, they don't understand, they know they don't understand, but they don't care because they're thrilled to be in the presence of, quote, important people and important stories.
Well, there's
so
something
I
else.
Began
I had
to
a,
see what he was doing.
I had a squabble with the New York Times during the Bush administration. I had a really top reporter, investigative reporter, come and want to write a story on me, and the Bush and the Kemp people didn't, the secretary's office didn't want them to do it. But they insisted on doing it. They wrote the story, and it was very complimentary, and then got a call from the print shop saying the Washington editor, without their permission, behind their back, had changed the story and tried to spike it. And they wouldn't allow it, had to go to the editor in New York and had to leave the New York Times and had to leave the industry. So, you know, if the powers that be wanted a story spiked in, you know, Washington Post, New York Times, I've seen it happen with all of them. A reporter who doesn't play ball is out on the street, or
quickly.
Worse. So, as you know,
let me give you an example of something. When I was talking with Ellis, he said, "Your job is to think of reality as a painting that is being painted for you, for everyone else in the world. It's a very large painting. It takes in every area of human life. And your job is to have a knife and to slice a big cut in the painting. That's what you do." I said, well, that's what I'm already doing. He said, yeah, but you've got to do it even more. And so in 2001, I sniffed out a story, which it took me quite a while, strangely enough, to find the basic source on. But the story was, the medical system in America is killing large numbers of people every year. I mean, big, big numbers. There's a little story in the LA Times. A few scientists were quoted. California Association of Pharmacists released a few figures that were alarming. They were talking about deaths from pharmaceutical drugs, etc. And finally, I ran it all down to an impeccable review article published on July 26, 2000 in the Journal of the American Medical Association by Dr. Barbara Starfield, who at the time and up until her recent death about 8 months ago was working as an emeritus kind of professor at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Widely respected in her field. Published an article called "Is U.S. Health Really the Best in the World?" And in the piece, based on her extensive research and review of other studies and so on, came to the following conclusion. Every year in the United States, the medical system kills 225,000 people. 119,000 of those people die in hospitals from various misadventures at the hands of doctors and nurses and so on, and infections and whatever. 106,000 people a year, like clockwork, are killed from the effects of pharmaceutical drugs prescribed by their doctors and approved as safe and effective by the FDA, which is the only way that a drug can ever get on the market. There was the study. Boom. And I said, wow. Because
that's a lot of people.
106,000 people a year, if you just take the pharmaceutical drugs, in a decade, you're talking about over 1 million people dead. We're not even talking about hospitalized people from the effects of these drugs or severe adverse effects when the people don't go to the hospitals. We're just talking about death, sheer death. So I pitched this story. And it was like talking to a Martian. The same Martian over and over again, you know. No matter where I went with it, it was the same Martian. And I would say, here's the story. And I would, you know, wrap it up in 60 seconds. And they would say, I'd say, what? And eventually, you know, I began to, through all their obfuscation, this and that and other thing, you know, I get the message, okay, it's a no. It's a no, it's another no, it's another no, and it's another no, it's another no. And I spoke with the editor of a significant magazine, and I said, look, why don't you look at it this way? You sell this story, but not just sell it, see. You pound it. This is Watergate multiplied 1,000 times. You pound it every month in your magazine, relentlessly. And I assure you that people will come out of the woodwork and confirm the story. I mean, I can already give you three confirming sources besides Starfield. But you'll get more people, big people, coming out and admitting that this is the truth. And this thing will steamroll and snowball, and you will eventually, after a year or so, have sales that will go through the roof that will be unbelievable. Do you understand what I'm trying to tell you? I mean, this isn't even a newspaper. If it was a Washington Post, they could save their lives. The New York Times, which is going so deeper in debt that they have to refinance their debt again, they could eventually resuscitate themselves. But nobody wants to do it. Nobody's interested. They all know that this would punch a significant hole in the matrix of interconnected strands of civilization, society, brainwashing, mind control, consensus reality. It would be a shock on the level of a medical 9/11 that would suddenly make people begin to sit up and say, I thought I knew everything about everything that was worth knowing anything about, but guess what? I don't. To some degree, I have been hypnotized. There is some effect that I've been suffering from on some level of my mind, whereby I accept the imagined, cooked-up story of what medical science is doing, and I am in a state of trance about it, and now I'm not.
What I found with people, John, is think of all of us as a computer who has an operating system and 100 databases, and we're not going to change our operating system just to update one database, but suddenly something comes along and we say, you know, it's worth changing the operating system because my kid has autism, I got to change this database. And that means I got to change the whole operating system, and that's what you're talking about.
And that's why health and medical science are so important, because,
For
example, and I spoke extensively with Ellis about Ritalin, and he said, well, you know a lot already. You've done a lot of research. I'm not telling you anything you don't know on the level of the science. I mean, Ritalin is a cheap form of speed. It's speed. Speed.
Right.
It's, you know, an amphetamine-like compound. Okay. And therefore, children or even adults, you know, they like to say, well, in children, it has a paradoxical effect of calming them down. No. No. In everybody, it tends to have an effect of sharpening your perception and your thought for a little while. Just like anybody who does speed for the first time says, where have I been all my life? This is wonderful, you see, while his brain cells are deteriorating and dying. And then upon repeated usage, eventually it leads to a crash. It used to be called a speed crash. And this is what happens to untold numbers of children, millions that are now being prescribed Ritalin for a disorder that has never been proven to exist as a discrete disease entity, but is the result of many, many, many different possible symptoms.
For all we know, Ellis Medavoy invented it.
Yeah, I mean, he sold it. He sold it.
Yeah.
He was one
of
the sellers of the story of ADHD and Ritalin. So he was telling me now, he said, look, how do you sell something like this? Well, you sell it to people, for example, who have children that are out of control. He said, don't you think I know something about my reliable sources? He said, don't you think I know a whole lot about them? That I can talk to them on a personal level? That I'm easy to talk to? That they spill their guts to me? That they tell me about this and that? And I tell them that a new era of treatment is on the horizon now. Not only Ritalin, but there will be Adderall, there will be new drugs, and they have to get into the pipeline. And this is not only important for their families and their children, but as reporters or sources for reporters, they owe it to the nation, the society, the community, to spread this far and wide and to make this, you know, a top-of-the-fold story that goes on and on and on and on and on. He said, so this is what I do. And in order to do this, I have to cover up certain things. For example, that we're just dealing with a cheap form of speed here. You know, I mean, you don't want to have doctors saying, hey, I'm going to give kids some speed, okay?
Before we leave Ellis, there's one thing I wanted to mention, because this is my favorite part of the interviews, is at one point you get really frustrated with him and you say, look, if it's so hopeless, if we're so easy to manipulate, And you know, it's so hopeless, why are you even bothering to talk to me? And he says, well, you know, no matter how much we thought we had everything locked down, there was like just this, you know, this intelligence that eluded us. You know, it was always one step ahead. And I would call it the divine intelligence. He didn't call it that. But, you know, what he was alluding to was a shared intelligence that somehow always outwits the control.
Well, that's right. And that's where in this new product, The Matrix Revealed, people will be very interested in reading the interviews with Jack True, of which there are 43, runs to 320 pages, of major conversations with a former friend and colleague who passed away in the mid-90s, who to me was the most innovative therapist in the world. Started out as a hypnotherapist. And as I was telling you on the phone this afternoon when we were chatting, after I think it was 7 years of intense practice as a hypnotherapist, he came to the shocking and disturbing revelation that the patients were walking into his office hypnotized. Right. So he said to me, he said, I sat down with myself and I said, what the hell am I doing? I mean, is the solution to this to put them in a deeper state of hypnosis than the trance they're already in? He said, this.
Would he get the trance to work even better?
Yeah, right. I mean, if he were working for the bad guys, which he had a couple of feelers, that's what he would have ended up doing. Mind control, serious mind control, because he knew the tricks and he knew the way to do that. And if that's what he had wanted to do, he could have done it. But he went the other way, fortunately, and came up with some of the most innovative, fantastic ideas about and practices and techniques about perception and reality and how people's minds coalesce with the matrix of the reality that has been painted for us, and how to unhook that connection, and how to resurrect not only the intellect and the rational mind and independent mind of an individual, but also his own creative imagination to untold of dimensions, so that the individual is so far separated from Matrix and the game of the Matrix that he or she is no longer being yanked and pulled back into it, can maintain that degree of independence and separation, and then go on to create the realities that they truly and profoundly and deeply desire in their lives. That became his project, his mission, his life's work, and he was brilliantly successful at it. So yes, there is that crack in the matrix, and Ellis did speak of it several times to me. In fact, later on, he began to say things like, you know, I don't think it's possible to make androids out of everybody on the planet. He said, in my former days, to me, that was a slam dunk sure thing. He said, but now I don't believe it. However, in order for people to disentangle themselves, step one is seeing how this matrix of reality is built, the nuts and the bolts of it, and how it applies to so many areas of life, including areas where people have blind spots.
One of the things I really want to talk about tonight is the notion of personal power versus getting attention. And I find one of the ways people get tricked back into the matrix is through processes that give lots and lots of attention. And let me just tell a story. I was in the 90s, I was trying to warn everybody about the housing bubble and what was coming down. And I was sitting with a friend who was on the phone just absolutely torturing Comcast over something related to their account. And I think they paid $39.95 a month. And what I realized was they were getting an enormous amount of corporate attention. And, you know, Comcast was just sucking up to them again and again and again. And I realized, you know, nobody is noticing the diminution of their political and legal power because they're getting massive infusions of consumer power. And they're thinking that all this attention, you know, is satisfactory, and they don't understand the consequences of losing, you know, particularly to their finances, of losing the personal power. But we see it again and again in many walks of life. And one of the interviews that I most love, it's hard because I love so many of them, is your interviews about Columbine, and because they bring up this issue in a very powerful way. So maybe if you could introduce the Columbine interview.
Yeah, we talked about that this afternoon. Over the rising hill come the grief counselors. That was a phrase that leapt into my mind about 3 days after the Columbine shootings, that just spread all over the globe. Because you nailed it perfectly in saying, instead of the people in that community, getting together and saying, hold on here, something horrible just happened, and we have to figure it out. wherever it leads us, whatever information that we discover, and there was plenty to discover. But even if they just had a vague inkling of that, at least they could have said, let's sit down and talk about this because we can't let this ride. But then, you see, as part of the op of Columbine, designed to terrorize people, make them think that they have absolutely no control over their lives, that they have to give up everything to the authorities, the experts, and so on. Here come armies and armies of grief counselors into town. You know,
yeah,
just like in the
old
West.
What's going on? It's clearly a symptom that you can't deal with your grief.
Exactly, you see.
Right.
Shifting the story. The story is now about your grief, and of course, let the healing begin. That's
right,
the story.
So you're getting massive amounts of taxpayer-funded attention. Just,
exactly.
You know,
tell us your
neurotic
story.
Building attention, and that is shutting you off from taking the steps you need to build and deal with the situation through any kind of personal power.
Where were you when it happened? How did you feel? Who were you with? And what was it with the phone call and the thing? And does this remind you of anything that happened earlier in your life? You see, taking you down the pole all the way as
right.
far as they can take you. And then you believe in that picture of reality. I am grief-stricken, I must heal. I am grief-stricken, I must heal. These people are helping me. You see? And I mean, yeah, it's a tragedy, but I'm sorry. It's also a farce in the aftermath.
Right.
The aftermath is pure farce because...
Right, the real healing comes when you get to the bottom of what really happened and how
yeah,
you can...
Yeah, what about
that
healing? You know, is there anybody
right.
who sat in front of one of these grief counselors and said, you know, I just had a great thought. If I can figure out what really happened that caused this thing, then I'll feel healed. Don't you agree?
Right.
No, 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 no. That couldn't be it because, you know, the grief counselors would go out of business. I mean, they're just pawns in the whole thing. You know, I mean, let's put the grief counselors out of business, you know, a big sign over Main Street in town. Let's get to the bottom of this.
You see
and
this
course,
all across using the intimate and giving attention to keep people away from the power lines. You see it again and again. And I told you the story this afternoon of the financial advisor who I particularly get frustrated with. She reminds me of one of the creatures from They Live. And and she's constantly imploring you to deal with, you know, what happened with your mother and father and the funny feelings you have about money. And if you look at probably what happened with mom and dad, you know, they got roasted by J.P. Morgan and their syndicate, and it made them grumpy at home, and that caused you to have feelings about money. And so the solution is get away from J.P. Morgan Chase and the syndicate. Well, no, what she says is this was a personal problem of theirs. You deal with it personally, and after you finish sort of working through the theories, then you can go back and bank at J.P. Morgan Chase with confidence. So the problem becomes the solution. Okay, but when it's, you know, you've gone through this incredibly intimate, personal, you know, grief process related to money, and it just, you know, it's all designed to get you over your fear and right back into the people who harvested your parents or, you know, caused the problem in the first place.
Exactly.
It's quite remarkable, but you know,
exactly.
I mean, it works again and again.
The person
again.
Is holding your hand. You're getting lots of attention. It
right.
feels good in a kind of creepy way. You're thinking, gee, there must be something here that all I have to do is kind of resolve it within myself because that's what's going on, and then we can get around the campfire and sing songs and, you know, all of this kind of stuff, which is, I mean, how can you succeed if you say there will be no campfires? There will be no memorials. There will be no candles. There will be no marches. There will be no weeping. You know, you can't say that because you say that to people and they say, shoot
Aww.
This guy right away. You know, we got to shoot him right away because he's trying to take our grief away from us. And the subliminal part of the mind control there is, as you say, he's trying to take away from us the attention that we're receiving for being the victims of this thing. And when we're spit out the other end of this pipeline, you know, subliminally, people know this, but they don't admit it to themselves, we'll be right back where we started from, in the matrix.
Right. Here is part of the challenge. It's one of the reasons I wanted to bring up Columbine. I've never met a school shooting that I didn't think wasn't a covert operation. And one of the hardest things I have to do is to, I did a whole special on mind control that's back in the archives for those subscribers who haven't listened to it. And it's very hard for many people to fathom that, you know, that the world is full of sort of trained and engineered Manchurian candidates, including kids. And those people are used to do things like school shootings if the elites want to get gun control. You know, these operations have, or, you know, say, if you look at the shooting in Arizona, say, if you don't want Congress people messing with Fast and Furious, you send a clear message, you know, don't mess with it. And, you know, and it's very hard for people to fathom that you have these kinds of professional operations involving children, but you do. And I think that's very painful to kind of face and recognize, you know, how did I get to this age and not know this was going on? So the alternative to the grief counselors is to face something that I think is very, very hard for many people to face.
Yes, I think it is. On the other hand, I know lots of people. When I started to get involved in 1990 in the health freedom movement at the time, which was just really taking off, the idea that people could and should have the right and the freedom to take care of their health any way they wanted to make responsible decisions on their own without being coerced by law or by federal agencies and so on, it really began to pick up steam in the early 90s. Eventually, I ran for a seat in the Congress out of 29th District in Los Angeles on that platform. And I began to meet lots of people who were health freedom warriors. These were some serious people. And I have to say that in all my 35 years of being a journalist, I have never met more focused, determined, powerful revolutionaries in the best sense of the word than people who got into it through health, because they discovered, you know, for their own themselves, with their own bodies, what happened when they began to do things that were supposed to be ridiculous and absurd and based in superstition and non-scientific and not approved by the government, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And a few of these people back then tipped me off and said, "What do you know about Prozac?" I said, "Well, you know, I know a little bit about it, antidepressant, blah, 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 blah. Do you know about people who take Prozac and murder other people or commit suicide quickly?" I said, "I've heard vaguely about it." I said, "Okay, look, we're going to bring you along a little bit here, because this is a battleground, a major battleground. And if you begin to look at the numbers of people that are taking these antidepressants, that's growing and growing and growing and growing. You begin to look at the landscape and you begin to see that it's like planting horrible seeds everywhere. And plants are going to grow from these seeds in different places at different times." And so knowing this and researching it more and discovering, you know, some of the really basic truth about these brain drugs and what they cause can cause people to do, when the school shootings became big news, I began to jump right into that. Oh, so these two shooters in Columbine were taking Luvox, which is another form of an SSRI antidepressant like Prozac. Oh, interesting. And Ritalin. Oh, I see. Uh-huh. And let's look at all these effects. And I ran that down chapter and verse. And it became quite clear to me, and I've written this countless times, you want to bring a country under your control? You want to make people so debilitated that it's all they can do to get by? You want to bring a nation, a world even, under your thumb? Eat it out from the inside, step by step, day by day, person by person, drug by drug, effect by effect, created in order to make people literally crazy, at which point they will do crazy things. And you'll never know about it. Cops don't want to know about it. The courts don't want to know about it. Herculean efforts have been launched in order to try to show what's really going on here. And time after time, federal agencies, law enforcement agencies, Department of Justice, local cops, judges, prosecutors don't want to know about it. And so what's happening here in terms of, as you are describing, an intentional operation to destroy and to, yes, limit your accessibility to Second Amendment rights, guns, limit your ability to think clearly, limit your ability to live your life. You just keep on seeding and spreading drug after drug after drug like this throughout the population. And these effects will spring up in various places, and people will be confused out of their minds. They will have no way of describing what happened. How could this be? We are living in a nice town, and all of a sudden this kid walks into a school with a gun and he shoots up the place. Now people are so inured to it that they don't even think about it anymore. Oh, another one. Yeah, another one. Yeah, post office. Yeah, walked into his business, walked into a school. This is the reality we must live with. Well, this reality was constructed for you. This was built. This was manufactured, literally manufactured.
Right, and it's not natural.
No, has nothing to do with natural behavior.
Right, and there's an intention behind it.
Exactly. And this is what...
You know, what you have to understand is the economics. If you look at the economics of rounding up people and putting them in labor camps during, you know, in Germany during the Nazis, the economics in the United States, you know, that was an expensive operation. Yes, you seized assets from them, but if you looked at the economics of that operation, it was not very profitable, and it had huge social costs. If you look at bringing drugs into poor neighborhoods and then rounding up innocent kids, throwing them into prison, and then issuing contracts to the Department of Defense for labor, that's a very profitable model because you have the citizens eager to pay. You know, they get some of the jobs. And, you know, it's like what you were talking about when we did the interview in California. It's like Auschwitz, but it's a hotel because it's profitable. So
yeah.
So if you look at the
and
model...
think of what it does in high-income neighborhoods, you know, because
right. In high-income neighborhoods, what Prozac does is it creates somebody who's much more profitable to harvest.
Exactly. Psychiatrist friend of mine, tell you a quick story, told me the following. And Medavoy confirmed not only that it was true, but that it was part of the operation. Kid takes Ritalin. 3 days later, wow, kid's concentrating. He's alert, wonderful, great. All right, 2 months later, not going well. Kid's starting to be out of control again, but in a different way than he was before. He's also depressed, and the depression worsens. Mommy takes kid back to the shrink. Shrink talks to the kid, this, that, and the other thing, and he says, well, what we're seeing here is the emergence of a new disorder, clinical depression.
Oh, no.
So we have to put the kid on an antidepressant. So now the kid's on Ritalin, and he's on Zoloft. The mother thinks, gee, I wonder if it has anything to do with the Ritalin. She might even bring it up, and he says, oh, of course not. It has nothing to do with that at all. This is... You know, this happens. You get multiple disorders. Blah, blah, blah. So now the kid is on the antidepressant. Okay. 3 months later, not doing well at all in any definition of doing well. Back to the psychiatrist. Psychiatrist says, new studies have shown that in children, there's a superior diagnosis, which is bipolar.
Oh.
This is what is happening. Bipolar. So what your kid needs is Depakote, and we're not going to put him on Depakote. And in fact, we may even have to put him on what's called an antipsychotic, which is the most damaging. And when I mean say damaging, I mean brain damaging of the psychiatric drugs. So now the kid is on a panoply of drugs, and he is captive in the system for the rest of his life, however long or short that is going to be. And he is going to develop physical problems that are going to demand other drugs. He's going to go to all kinds of specialists. He is now a profit-making machine.
He's like something, you know, how a stockbroker turns an account.
You got it.
The entire medical industry now has an account that they are free to turn.
You bet. You bet. And they work it from every possible angle so that this kid is now 26 years old. Can't work, can't find a job, couldn't work if he could find a job. He's living at home. He's on some kind of disability, but it's not enough. And nobody really knows what to do, but periodic trips back to the doctors, new diagnoses, new drugs, in the system for the rest of his life.
It's interesting. I opened up Money and Markets with the report from the Congressional Budget Office. But if you look at the federal budget with income down and health care expenses exploding, it's just a macroeconomic picture of exactly what you're describing. You have an entire society which is organized to be not productive.
You got it. That's it. Medavoyer said to me once, they want to make the entire nation into a hospital. He said, that's a goal. He said, if you have that target in mind and you know what it means, you can do it. Turn the entire nation into a cradle-to-grave hospital. And not only that, and here's where some of the attention that you were talking about comes in. He said, people will wear these badges proudly. What disorder do you have? Well, I've got, ADHD. Well, geez, that's nothing. I'm bipolar. Well, I was diagnosed as psychotic for 6 months because people talk about their diseases all the time. But, of course, it gets pumped up and it gets accelerated. And so now you have people whose main subject of conversation really in their lives is the pride that they take in the drugs they're taking, the diagnoses they've received, the complexity of the diagnosis, the surgeries they had to undergo, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because they're receiving attention.
We gain our prestige from the process of losing our power.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Okay, I want to spend some time on imagination. I want to save some time. So we have a little bit more time for one more piece of the interview because there's so many I love, John. And I just have to say to everybody listening, you have to get this collection. It's just a treasure. One of the interviews was a nurse who literally lived a covert life interceding and helping save people from the cancer establishment. So maybe if you could just describe the renegade nurse.
This was one of the most amazing forays that I've ever done. Through various connections, I met this woman, one of the most tough-minded people I've ever come across in my life, because she would intervene.
This was
outside the matrix all the way. She lived on the go. She had no permanent address. She knew how to operate on the road through her connections, which she handled like an intelligence case officer, you know. I mean, a good one, though, to make sure that security was maintained. She would be invited into certain people's homes who had been half destroyed or almost completely destroyed by the medical system, and she would begin to work with these people. And in sometimes the most harrowing of situations, because half the family is saying, you have to be with the doctor, and you have to do what the doctor says, and here comes the stranger into the house, and the stranger can't even let on what the stranger is doing, meaning the nurse, And she has people she's working with, other practitioners, experts, and she comes in and has one of her people do an assessment of what really is happening with the person at the moment. What are the drugs? What are the effects of the drugs? What is the nutritional profile of the person? What do they need? What level of healing from what vector? Decisions made possible only by years of relentless experience in dealing with people. And sometimes the problems are, you know, intensely psychological and spiritual as well. And this was her life. And she would reverse the most amazing things with people and then disappear, never to be heard from again by those people. On to the next, on to the next. And she viewed her mission in life as a traveling doctor. And she made no bones about her assessments of medical treatments. So that, you know, occasionally she'd go into a house and she'd say, this is what's happened to you. Here are the drugs on your night table, and I'm going to tell you what the effects of these drugs are, and you're going to tell me what you've experienced. And some of these people were not up to it. They just couldn't handle it because it shook their reality too much, and they would rather die than have a chance at health. But others were miraculous, what she was able to
do. What you realize is she's moving from place to place, saving people from being killed by medicine.
That's right.
And
that's what
it's very dangerous. I mean, one of the things that you feel is the danger she's in. It's dangerous because you're not
And sometimes it was close calls. Doctors who had gotten wind of what was happening, reporting to police, reporting to FBI, reporting to medical societies, all kinds of stuff happening that she was able to somehow balance all of this. She had a kind of an intuition to know when the danger was okay to operate with him. And when it was time to leave.
Right.
So it wasn't just like, oh, hi, and this and that. No, because, you know, somebody's got cancer. Okay, well, in the cancer establishment, when you've got a oncologist treating somebody, and that person is being pumped for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars and drugs and drugs and drugs that are killing them, and somebody's going to come down the pipeline out of nowhere and suddenly say directly, this is a total fraud, and I'm going to do something that's going to help you. And this person is a registered nurse who has had vast experience within the medical establishment and knows the score. Now she poses a significant risk to the Matrix, and they will come after her. And she knew that. She prepared for it. She had no, there were no waffles about this. She knew, eyes wide open, what she was in to do.
Right, which is ultimately where we all want to get to, is to deal with it eyes wide open.
That's right,
eyes
really,
wide it's
open.
It's really getting that freedom of mind that gives you the power to kind of rock and roll and avoid the real trouble.
And she told me, she said, I never could have done this if I hadn't been at the bedsides of many people who were killed by chemo, who were burned by radiation, who were cut without needing to be cut, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. She said the years, the knowledge, the emotion piled up and up and up and up to the point where I knew enough and I was fed up enough to walk out the door and never come back and do what I'm doing now, which is a perfect metaphor for all aspects of the Matrix. It's why I put this whole thing together, because you see it, you read it, you hear the nuts and bolts, you know it, and you say, okay, now what? And when you read the Jack True interviews, the now what is the most wonderful thing in the world, which is, as Jack demonstrated time and time and time again with clients in the most beautiful way, when you get a person back in the seat of the power of their own imagination and
wow.
capacity to create and invent reality, they are now in touch with their true desires at a level that is so profound that they are situated outside that matrix, and they ain't coming back. And they're going to create
yep.
realities of their own.
Now, one of the questions we got that I told you about earlier was somebody said, you know, I've been to your website. There's so many audios. Where do I begin? If somebody wants to tap in, so I get the matrix revealed, I read the interviews, I'm ready to tap into my imagination. How do I come to your website and access the information to help me do that?
Okay, two things. Go to nomorefakenews.com. Get on the mailing list. Go to the store, click on John Rappaport Products, and order the following audio seminars: Mind Control, Mind Freedom, The Transformations, and Imagination Exercises for a Lifetime. That puts your feet squarely on the road. And I always try to say this to people, if in doing any of these exercises or going through the material you have any questions, my email address is right there on the website at the bottom of every one of my stories. Email me. Tell me what it is. I will answer the question. I will do everything I can to help you.
Now, I would like to point out that whenever I have these audio seminars on my iPod, and whenever I'm stuck in an airport, you know, and the TVs are blaring and the walls are closing, and what I do is I immediately turn to that, to Mind Control, Mind Freedom, one of my favorites, and I start to listen, and then I start to survey the environs, and I just start to laugh. It's really, for some reason, you're very big for me in airports, John. You know, because that's the one place.
Yeah, that's a real good place.
That's a real good place.
Yeah, that's
now,
like...
Now, if they want to do a consultation, how do they find you?
Just give out my mailing address. I have clients. I do consulting work. QJRconsulting@gmail.com. Just shoot me an email, and I'll describe exactly the kind of consulting work I do. It all has to do with everything that we're talking about tonight. So you've gotten some background on it already, but I'll give you the rest. And
I have
yes,
my instructions on how to do your exercises always on my bedside table. It's one of my favorite things to do at the end of the table. At the end of the day, is to do some John Rappaport exercises.
Well,
before we close, two things. One, is there anything you would like to add other than we have to do this again?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That's what I wanted to say at the very end. We have to do this again many times because, you know, when we have, I don't know, 2-3 hours to sit and talk and the conversation, you know, goes both ways, and I'm intensely interested in everything that you have to say and everything that you write. And, I mean, when I read the book on Dylan Reed, explosions, fireworks of beautiful dimensions went off in my head on so many different levels, and all of your other work. We just click, and so we should do a lot more of this, because in the spontaneity of talking back and forth, all kinds of things will emerge that we don't even know about yet.
Right. Well, I have to tell you, I'm profoundly grateful, because it can get lonely outside the matrix. And I think,
yeah.
You know, trying to hold the framework and the pictures only that you create, when you have other really powerful minds helping you do that, and there's something, not only are you just fearless and extraordinary integrity, but you make me laugh. Nobody makes me laugh like you laugh, because you see the matrix and you just illuminate the absurdity. In that tape that, instead of Let's Go to the Movies, I put up our videotape of the conversation we did last year out in Laura's clinic, and when you said, "Oh, you're talking about how vaccines are sort of like the Nazi experiments, but one up, and it's friendly, and it's kind of like it's not it's like Auschwitz, but it's like a hotel." Anyway,
yeah.
So they're very you are very good at nailing the not only the revulsion of the Matrix, but the absurdity, ultimately the absurdity of it. So
I agree. Ultimately the absurdity. And you know, to be outside of it and to have
you have to laugh.
Like you gotta laugh. I mean, you gotta laugh, because if you start weeping at a certain point, you know, you're suddenly going to open your eyes and say, "Hey, I'm back in." How did that happen?
Oh, but I laugh because I'm so grateful to be free of it. You know,
yeah.
I struggled for years trying to be a good soldier and be free and be successful and get along. And, you know, that pathway is not there. You have to choose. It's one or the other. And I was, you know, I was led to the conclusion you could never get free, but I kept looking for a way to get free. And the odd thing was, the only way you could get free, you know, for someone like me, is to get kicked out, which is exactly what happened. And so, you know, the boys did me a favor because they kicked me all the way out. If I had moved all the way out the way I have without getting kicked out, you know, I doubt I could have made it. But, you know, I know one thing is I'm deeply grateful to be out. And part of being out and staying out is really to see it whole. And no one person can do that by themselves. And I can't think of anybody who's done as much for me to help me sort of break down the nuts and bolts, because that's important to me. I'm a nuts and bolts person. I have to see the time and money. And I think the interviews just broke it down, nuts and bolts, in so many of the worlds that I didn't have immediate access to. I could discern it as a financial person from afar, but to get inside and to get the nuts and bolts from the insiders, that was a brilliant, brilliant stroke. So anyway, ladies and gentlemen, The Matrix Revealed, you can find it at No More Fake News. I promise I will have more John Rappaport interviews. John, thank you so much for joining us on the Salieri Report.
You
have a great week.
Love
okay,
you.
Coming up next week is Precious Metals with Franklin Sanders. Precious Metals has moved up a lot, so we have a lot to talk about the following week, and it's not surprising that you'd know I want to do this, especially after listening to John. We're going to be talking about healthcare proxies. It's very important that you not find yourself alone in a hospital without somebody you can trust who really loves you, who's got the power to rock and roll and be your advocate. And then in the first week of March, there's one I want to do. It's going to be a special by me on faith and the big questions. Next week, a reminder again, I'm going to be on Saturday in Palm Springs in California at the Cambridge House Natural Resource Conference. So if you have time to come out, just let me know you're a subscriber, and I'll do my best to make sure I have time to answer your questions. So until next week with Franklin Sanders and Precious Metals, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.